And we'll say, I'm gonna sing out. I'm gonna march on. And everybody said,
I'm gonna sing out.
Gonna march on.
I'm gonna march on.
Gonna put one foot in front of the other foot.
I'm gonna sing out.
Gonna march on. Got to keep on going.
I'm gonna sing out.
Gonna march on.
I'm gonna march on.
When my grandmama marched.
Hi there. I'm Jeff Browning, and welcome to Benders of the Arc podcast, where we interview movers and shakers for social change.
Well, good morning. Mark, it's great to have you with us. As way of introduction, Mark is the former pastor for the Church of Reconciliation in North Carolina. And Mark spent something like 40 years in ministry and is now retired and is now serving as the executive director for Voices for Justice in Palestine. Welcome, Mark. And
thank you, Jeff.
Do us a favor and fill in your history there a little bit more for us. I know you spent some time. Did you grow up part of the time in Beirut?
Yes, I could start there. My parents were fraternal workers with the Presbyterian Church back in the 60s. Both of them were professors and taught at the Beirut College for Women, which was one of the Presbyterian missions in the Middle East. And I was there from 1960 until 1963, little boy of six, nine when we left. And that's an important piece in my story, which we can come back to a little bit later if you want, when I'm talking about how I got interested in the Israel-Palestine conflict and finding my way in the midst of that in terms of my voice and my contribution to a just and lasting peace.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Tell us a bit about the work of VJP. And some of the history of the organization.
Right. Glad to do that. As it happens, the Triangle area, Chapel Hill, Durham, and Raleigh in North Carolina, central North Carolina, is a place that's been a kind of a hotbed of activism for the Israel-Palestine issue, peace with justice approach to that issue. Since about the early 2000s, there was a group called the Coalition for Peace with Justice. I was on their board. They helped send me to the Middle East, to Israel and Palestine in 2013 with one of the FASNA trips, the Friends of Sabeel North America trip. Amazing, life-changing experience. Then after I retired in 2019, another group I had helped to found called the Abrahamic Initiative on the Middle East, which is an interfaith focus. I formed it with a Jewish activist, and we reached out to several Muslim and Palestinian folks in the community and formed this community group called the Abrahamic Initiative on the Middle East. The Coalition for Peace with Justice and the Abrahamic Initiative in the Middle East merged to become Voices for Justice in Palestine. And I've been their first executive director. And really the merger has been really galvanizing for the movement, lots of new energy. And then of course, recently, just a great deal of work around the work for a ceasefire and other things, which we can come back to as well. But yeah. The Voices for Justice in Palestine is a nonpartisan, interfaith, nonprofit focused on a just and lasting peace in the Middle East, working with Palestinian solidarity activists of all stripes. So there are Christians, there are the Jewish Voice for Peace are our partners, and we collaborate closely with them on a number of projects. And then also a number of the the Muslims for Social Justice in our area, labor unions, a lot of progressive groups. It's a broad-based coalition. There's some who are part of our organization, members in our group, but as many more, we're partners with and collaborating coalitions.
Yeah, well, that sounds wonderful. And it seems important that this is an interfaith effort as well.
Yes.
So do you, who else serves on your board? I mean, you mentioned Muslim organizations, I think JVP. Are there any other organizations, NGOs that you collaborate with?
I mentioned Muslims for Social Justice. There's a group called Samadun, which is the prisoner network for Palestinian prisoners. Several labor unions, Black Workers for Justice is one of our groups that we interact with. It's been a really wonderful experience to get to know several of the young Jewish Voice for Peace activists and know more about their particular stories and be called upon to be part of their efforts and to call on them to be part of our efforts and really to collaborate. Also, it's brought me closer to Palestinian Americans and their concerns and struggles. Also, a lot of them have family still in the West Bank, some in Gaza. And so you get a completely different picture from talking to them and having them share their experiences and the things that they're hearing from their family members and from villages in the West Bank and other places. So it's been rich on a personal level. It's deepened my understanding of the issues and really opened up vistas for involvement and activism in ways that I barely knew before I came into this work.
Well, tell us a little bit more about your own history and why this is of particular interest to you.
It's an interesting question, Jeff. Let me start with that. It was one earlier experience before the one I was going to tell you about my days in Beirut. My dad was Presbyterian pastor and had done a PhD in comparative religions at Princeton, and he had studied with a famous Islamic scholar. So he was very interested in the history of the Middle East, a scholar of Islam, as well as a Presbyterian pastor with deep Christian commitments. So he's very interfaith in his focus. And he took a church in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan after graduating from seminary, small iron ore mining town called Ishpeming, way up there near the Canadian border, near Lake Superior. About 9 months of snow up there. And I remember one time when I was a little boy, I'm probably 5 years old. He liked to walk around in the community and see people and talk to them downtown. And they knew him as the pastor of the local Presbyterian church. Very friendly, outgoing person, my dad. And so he invited me along on one of these walks where it was really kind of fun to be with dad going around downtown. And he took a little deliberate right turn from the center part of town down toward where the railroad tracks were. And this would have been in the late 1950s, actually. I was born in 53, so, you know, maybe mid to late 50s before we went over to Beirut. And he took me to this little hobo village. And the hobos were, you know, the poor at the time who ran with the trains and rode the trains all over the country. And he took me to one of those villages, and he'd actually met a couple of the guys, and they invited us in to sit with them around the fire. And it was amazing to sort of have an insight into that world. And when we left, my dad said, you know, there are people who live their lives in the shadows. And we have so much to learn from them. I hope you'll always remember that. And in a way, I think what he was doing was basically introducing me to sort of that central thing in scripture, which is God's preferential option for the poor and the oppressed. In his own way, he was saying, you know, look to the underside of history, make that be a focus in your life. He had no idea I was going to decide to be a minister and go into work and study political theology at the graduate level or any of those things I ended up doing. But it really left an impact on me that the focus of my life in some way and my moral compass is around this perspective of the downtrodden or the underside of history. And so here I am in Beirut as a boy of about 7 or 8, I guess, is when this happened. And I was with some of my friends, and we were, you know, doing what mischievous boys do, getting into trouble. And we stacked up a number of milk crates along this big high wall. I had no idea what was on the other side of the wall, but we wanted to check it out. So we climbed up to the top and looked over. And it was one of the Palestinian refugee camps. This would have been 1962. And these were refugees who had been displaced from their homes, forcibly displaced off their land, out of Palestine, into Beirut, into Lebanon, and then on up to Beirut. And they were in these camps that would have been 14 years as refugees. And I'll never forget the image of seeing this crowded village, not even really a village, just sort of a loose gathering of concrete shacks with tin roofs and no garbage pickup, and, you know, languishing in statelessness and squalid conditions, unable to assimilate in Arabic society, I later learned, the Lebanese society, and yet unable to return back to their homes in Palestine. So they were in this kind of endless limbo, dependent on the largesse of the UN refugee organizations and the Red Cross, but unable to really have a future or a life. And I remember at the time, just still a boy, but because of these early formative experiences from my father, just thinking how really horrible it was that this group of human beings were being treated this way. So I think I had, in my own little nascent way, a kind of a heart for the plight of the Palestinian people. And that really has stayed with me over the years. And it's been a real joy later in my life, now I just turned 70, to be actively involved in living out that vision.
Hmm. What an amazing family history that you have. And what a gift your father was to help you to see with the eyes of those who are in the shadows. I'm just so grateful for him and for you, wish that more of us could have that perspective. Thank you for sharing that. So I know that we've heard many NGOs that are describing what the situation is in Gaza with this disaster, and I'm wondering, what is your assessment of the situation there with your community, through the Voices for Justice in Palestine? I mean, do you have contacts on the ground there? You said that there are some folks that actually have family members in the West Bank or Israel or Gaza. Are you actually able to get any information about what's happening over there?
Yes. Thanks for that question, Jeff. I'm really glad to have an opportunity to share with you some of those insights and perspectives that I've been privileged to have from these contacts. The chair of our board for Voices for Justice in Palestine is a physician and pharmacist, a National Institute of Health scientist named Burhan Ghanayem. And he's from a small village near Tulkarm in the West Bank. And so he still has family there and visits them as often as he can. And he told me that his brother, who lives in the little family home, the ancestral home that his great-grandfather built, the other day, maybe it was about a week ago, settlers from the local settlement, heavily armed, backed by Israeli soldiers, came to his home. And there was a very menacing presence, and attached a poster to the front door of his house. And they had somebody write it in Arabic. although his brother speaks English as well and knows some Hebrew, saying, leave this house and your lands and all your possessions within 24 hours or you'll be killed.
Oh my gosh.
And that is the kind of thing that they remember from the Nakba from 1947 to 49, when over 750,000 Palestinians were forcibly expelled from their homes and their lands. And it's not an exaggeration to say that there is another Nakba, or the Arabic word for catastrophe, describing that period of time now almost 70 years, over 70 years ago, 75 years ago, when so many Palestinians were driven off their land and out of their homes to live exactly this life that I glimpsed at age 9 in Beirut, essentially in statelessness and limbo. So it's terrifying for the people who live there. Palestinians are in the West Bank are generally, even if they were inclined to protect themselves by carrying arms or having a rifle in the house or any such thing, most of them are not inclined that way. But they've also been disarmed by the Palestinian Authority, so they are utterly defenseless. The Palestinian Authority is not going to help them. And these settlers are, you know, armed with automatic weapons, and they're fanatical in their belief that all of this land was given to them by God, and they do not acknowledge the rights of the Palestinians who live who are their neighbors who live nearby, and they do have this sense that now is the time when they have two rabid settlers that are actually cabinet ministers with command and control. Ben-Gavir in particular has control over the West Bank and the security in the West Bank. And he has personally armed these settlers with automatic weapons. And they are carrying out these acts of dispossession and in some cases killing or incarcerating these Palestinians. So although our attention is properly focused on Gaza, there is much more out of view, a lower scale but deeply disturbing Nakba happening again in the West Bank.
Let's take a break. And when we return, Mark will describe the sad irony that so many progressive folks support this war that is killing so many innocent women and children. Stay with us.
And we'll say, I'm gonna sing out, I'm gonna march on. And everybody said,
I'm gonna sing out,
gonna march on.
If you are new to our podcast, please visit our blog at bendersoftheark.com, where you can find more information about our stories and the people behind them. Now let's return to our guest.
I'll say just a word or two about Gaza. There's much more coverage about that. I have been really shocked and disturbed. I shouldn't be shocked. I've seen this before, but still it shocks me and shocks my conscience. The way that so many, you know, good-hearted, otherwise progressive, liberal people who do great work on other issues seem to be just lockstep with this government position, which is a sort of a coordinated propaganda program between Tel Aviv and Washington, between the Israeli and U.S. governments. Congress, for the most part, is on board with all this. Biden administration completely all in. This coordinated idea that, you know, if you love Israel, you can't be in favor of a ceasefire. Why? Even though over 18,000 Palestinians have been killed in this merciless bombing campaign, indiscriminate bombing, you know, hospitals, mosques, churches, cultural centers, and most tellingly, homes. I mean, nearly 2 million people have lost their homes instead of creating cruel homelessness now as winter is setting in the Gaza Strip. No real plans for what's going to happen with all these people. You know, there's all these reasons to be horrified by what's happening there, to be totally against it, to be demanding a ceasefire. And yet our government has this position that, no, we're going to green light this genocidal destruction. It's estimated another 1,400 children will likely die before Christmas, already over 8,000 and thousands buried in the rubble. It's just a horrific situation. And yet you have ordinary, you know, good-hearted people feeling like, well, you know, we really have to get rid of Hamas. And unfortunately, you know, conditions of war, civilians lose their lives and all of that stuff. It's just propaganda. And it turns out now that we're seeing Israel's intentions are much clearer. And it seems as though there really is, in this far right-wing government that Netanyahu has assembled, there really, really are plans to essentially thin out the population, to deliberately kill as many Palestinians as possible. They'll say differently, but you know, look at what they do, not what they say. The actions belie the rhetoric, and drive them ultimately out of Gaza or down into crowded areas, make the circumstances so unlivable that there will be no possibility for any meaningful sovereignty for any leadership that's Palestinian. And then the whole thing is we have to do this to maintain peace and security for Israelis. And I think there's a great fear among many people. They don't want to be labeled as anti-Semitic. They don't want to be critical of the policies of Israel, even though they meet the textbook criteria for genocide. And I would just refer our any of your readers who are skeptical about that, or your viewers, to the work of Roz Segal, S-E-G-A-L, a Holocaust and genocide scholar from Stockton University, himself Jewish and raised in Israel, who says that if you look at the UN Convention on the Prevention and the Punishment of Genocide, which was written in 1948 after World War II and the Holocaust, it lays out the specific conditions the criteria for calling something genocide, and Israel has met almost all of them. I think there are five. I think four without any question. Maybe some question about the fifth, but it's led him to be very clear about calling this a genocide and urging people to do everything they can to bring it to a halt.
Yeah. You know, it's just beyond imagining the horror of what people are suffering now, and I understand that the U.S. has also greenlighted the transfer of more weapons, more tank shells, in particular, to Israel. And I guess what I find most troubling is that this comes without not only bypassing the oversight of Congress, but it seems to transgress our own rules, laws, and policies on the transfer of weapons when we know that those weapons are going to be used against civilians or are going to violate the rules of war. Do you know anything more about that? Can you give us any more?
Yeah, you're spot on all that you've said there, Jeff. It's deeply disturbing that the United States, under the Biden administration, with full assent from Congress, there may be, you know, the Senator Van Hollen from Maryland has drafted an amendment, and I think he's got maybe a dozen Democratic senators signed on with him about the supplemental that's being debated now. And this amendment, it basically says we already have laws on the books in the Arms Export Control Act and the Leahy Law that specifically prohibit the use of military weapons, U.S. military weapons, being used by any sovereign state to commit any violations of human rights. And there are reporting conditions that, you know, responsibilities that go with all of that. That's just American law. Now, it should be said that there has been a kind of a wink and a nod and a looking the other way with all the previous times that Israel bombed Gaza in 2008, 2014, 2021, or the major ones, and there have been others as well. Those were all U.S. weapons, and they were all used with white phosphorus, you know, burning people alive, and, you know, all of that stuff was done. And there was never any real accountability for the war crimes that happened there, or any hesitation to continue to arm Israel to the teeth, even though under international law, Israel has functioned essentially as a rogue state, egregious violator of human rights on numerous occasions. And we're seeing it all over again now to the 10th, 15th, 100% exponential level. In what's happened in Gaza. But, you know, if your viewers have an opportunity to Google the name Josh Paul, State Department employee who had direct responsibility at this transfer of weapons level, and he was just astonished that the governmental position coming out of the Biden administration and backed up by Congress was, we will apply zero conditions, that's the language, zero conditions on the use of our weapons by Israel. And that's a flagrant violation of our own laws. And I would just say that, you know, the political philosopher Thomas Hobbes said that negligent enforcement of the law weakens the very power of law itself. Mm-hmm. And can lead to a terrifying absence of law, which he described as the state of nature. And he famously described that as a state which is poor, solitary, nasty, brutish, and short. And we are seeing nasty, brutish, and short unfolding by the day in Gaza. And we are complicit in all of it. Yeah. And it's just heartbreaking and sickening to see our government just lockstep with all this propaganda and this meeting out of death to innocent people. I am just sleepless at night and just very sickened and heartbroken by what I've seen from my own government. I was on a call just yesterday with Senator Tom Tillis, the Republican senator in my state, one of the two Republican senators in North Carolina, and this guy is the head of the co-chair of the Committee on Human Rights. Mm-hmm. And his military advisor, who we spoke with and urged him to encourage his boss to sign off on a ceasefire and join these other resolutions and join the Van Hollen Amendment, which is saying, hey, let's follow our own laws. I mean, we've got these laws on the books for a good reason. Let's follow them. And he's just lockstep with the whole thing of, I support Israel. Israel has to eradicate Hamas. And it's unfortunate that we have all these deaths, but it's because Hamas is using them as human shields. You know, it's just crazy that the appetite for I call it pornography. It's really atrocity pornography that's being used to turn people into, willing accomplices to genocide.
Yeah, it is heartbreaking. Do you have any information about whether or not the administration is supplying guns to settlers in the West Bank?
The last I know about this, and I have not done, rigorous investigation of it, but I did see a video of Ben-Gvir himself, the cabinet minister, opening boxes full of automatic weapons and personally handing them to settlers. And we know from our Palestinian friends that every settler in the areas that we know folks in are heavily armed with these automatic weapons. And those are military grade rifles that have been issued to them. Now, that has been done, my understanding is, under the auspices of the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force. But because of this close cooperation between the Israeli government and the U.S. government. In essence, we are handing out those guns. I don't know that they are, you know, where they were produced. I don't know all those details. But, you know, I will just say that the official position, and you can hear this in the statements from the spokespeople, is that there is, here's the phrase, no daylight between Israel's national interests and the U.S. national interests, that we are essentially one with the state of Israel. Yeah. And to me, that is just terrifying, because the whole rest of the world regularly lines up to say, we want Israel to stop violating human rights. We want them to stop carrying out an apartheid regime. All of these things are killing innocents. All of these are egregious violations of international law. And you know, this most recent ceasefire resolution that the U.S. vetoed in the Security Council had 153 nations of the 193 all on board saying it must stop.
Yeah.
And yet we stand alone, virtually alone, a couple Pacific Island atolls who follow up with us. But for the most part, the rest of the world in its wisdom says, this has to stop. And yet the way things are set up, it can keep going. There's no sign there'll be any accountability for all the deaths. Israel really does have a green light to continue doing this. And the only thing that can stop them really is the United States. And the irony of the whole thing is one phone call could stop it. They keep talking about, well, Israel, we've told them that they really must observe the rules of law. They have to bring the civilian casualties down, et cetera, et cetera. But then when they don't, there's really no consequence. So, you know, they're functioning with impunity. And one Israeli theorist and scholar on these issues said, you know, if the United States public is basically okay with us killing 5,000, they'll be okay with us killing 10,000. So all this rhetoric is just hot air. And the only thing that keeps it from being hot air is that single phone call, which could come from from Washington. It would have to come from the president. And I don't see Biden doing this, but that would say the weapons flow stops now.
Yeah.
And until that happens, all of it is just much ado about nothing, because they have the weapons they need. And they've even conceded, you know, if the United States says we're not going to backfill these orders, we're not going to give you the ammunition when it runs out, or no more tank shells, no more F-16s, no more 2,000-pound bunker buster bombs, all of it stops because of the way you've carried out the way you've used these weapons, which is a violation of our laws and international humanitarian law. But we're not going to allow it to continue. And that's all it would take for this to stop. And that's the very call that, for all kinds of complex reasons, is not being made. And the only thing I think that we have any hope of doing is to continue this grinding work of meeting with our congressional representatives and saying, we are your public, you work for us, we are your constituents. Large majorities of the American public say it's time for a ceasefire. Time to pull the plug on this whole disastrous strategy and, you know, work toward addressing the roots of the violence and the roots of the conflict, and work meaningful peace negotiation, and, you know, get past the cynicism that says the only thing we can do is back Israel. They're our ally. And this fanatical destruction of Gaza, which is, I think, largely formed by revenge, is the only thing we can do.
Well, and I, boy, there's so much to say about this.
I kind of ran on a little bit there. Sorry.
It's I am with you there, but you know, we're sacrificing our moral authority around the world. The United States is just being, you know, rightly so, viewed as being, you know, we're holding Israel's coat right, while they do this dirty work. And that's heartbreaking to think that, you know, to know that any moral standing that we have in the world is just being undermined day by day.
Yes.
And I keep asking myself and wanting to ask my representatives, how many people need to be killed before we're willing to say this has to stop? I mean, it's now about 18,000. Is it
And
25?
over,
Is it 50? Is it 100?
right.
Is it half a million? Because I don't know where this ends.
Right. Yeah. It's so well said, Jeff. I mean, I think part of the problem is that, and even longtime Israel supporter, somebody like columnist Thomas Friedman in the New York Times has raised questions about the fact that there seems to be no clear end game, or the end games that's being discussed from the Israeli government are things which are shocking violations of international humanitarian law. There's a particular plan already released from the one of the intelligence services within Israel that basically says the plan is to make Gaza so unlivable that they are able to drive the remaining population, whatever that is. It could be 2 million, could be 100 and 180, well, 800,000 or something like that, and depending on how many people lose their lives. But the remaining population will be just driven out into the Sinai Desert to live in tents. And then plan is already for Israel to reoccupy Gaza. And in that sense, thin out the population of Palestinians and make them the problem of the international community. Israel just wash their hands of, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, perhaps as many as a million, and dump them onto Egypt and the, I mean, I just, that's a completely untenable and unacceptable plan. And yet, if there is an end plan from the this current Israeli government, it's that kind of scenario that they're talking about. So then it's like, well, even if you thought it was legitimate to spend all this money and send all these weapons for this idea of eradicating Hamas, a lot of smart people have said you're not going to be able to eradicate Hamas. Maybe you kill 15,000 of their fighters. We don't actually know how many there are, but for every one you've killed, you've radicalized the next 10 in the next generation. I mean, and it's the same thing about sacrificing our moral authority. It's also creating conditions of enormous hostility toward Israel and to the United States. And that is going to have reverberations throughout the Arab world. And the irony in the whole thing, Jeff, is that there was a time in fairly recent history where the Arab world loved the United States. And I'm thinking about that period of time before Harry Truman rushed to recognize Israel as an independent country in 1948. Up until that time, the Arabs were furious with the Brits and furious with the French. And they thought the United States, with its work building universities, American University in Beirut, American University in Cairo, all these hospitals, all this work was so enlightened, and people loved the United States, and they believed in democracy, and we had moral authority. We had moral authority, unlike the imperial powers that had carved up the Middle East in the Sykes-Picot Agreement in 1916 and the Balfour Declaration in 1917. All of these things, which we were not party to that. And so the United States really had an opportunity to build a very different relationship with the Arab world, and had done, I would say, actually, with a lot of Presbyterian ministers. My parents were part of that work of building collegial friendships with the Arab world, and helping build hospitals and universities, and building up the human flourishing of the Arab world. And we were known as a nation as the ones who would bring that, and we could collaborate for all the good of everybody. And then in 1948, when Truman made that very sort of hasty decision, really against the advice of many in his own State Department, to recognize Israel, basically built on stealing another country's land. I mean, that all of that was stolen land. And the decision to do that really brought about a disastrous paradigm shift between the United States and the Arab world. And there's a wonderful historian named Usama Makdisi, who's at Berkeley in the Near East Studies Department. He wrote a book called Trust Misplaced. And it talks about how the trust of the Arab world had been placed in the United States, but after 1948 and everything that's happened since then, and certainly lately, has sent a very, very different message to the Arab world.
Let's take another break, and when we return, we'll talk about yet another missed opportunity.
And we'll say, I'm gonna sing out, I'm gonna march on. And everybody said,
I'm gonna sing out,
gonna march on.
If you are new to our podcast, please visit our blog at bendersoftheark.com, where you can find more information about our stories and the people behind them. Now let's return to our guest.
Well, and I'm cognizant also of 1953 when we went into Iran.
Yes. Oh, gosh.
supported the coup against Mossadegh.
Yep.
And installed the Shah in his place. You know, what a extraordinary achievement it was to have a democratically elected president of Iran.
Yep.
And because of our corporate fealty, we decided we could not let that stand, and installed the Shah in his place, a brutal dictator for, you know, I don't know, 30 plus years. So, well, I guess in the short time we have left, I just wanted to ask, what is it that citizens need to do? I mean, how do we break through? I've been calling my representatives, mm-hmm. but I feel like, you know, it's so frustrating because I can just imagine them on the other line, you know, throwing this little note into the circular file. How do we make a difference?
Well, it's such an important question, and the only thing I know to say in the short term, when we're all pressing so hard for an end to the slaughter of the innocents, an end to the violence, pressing so hard for a permanent ceasefire, is, you know, one of the virtues of that is it's a very straightforward ask. Ceasefire. Permanent ceasefire. That's the one thing right now that's so urgent. And I would, you know, people should get linked up with Jewish Voice for Peace, if not now. Both of those Palestinian solidarity activists made up of Jewish Americans who are passionate about justice and peace and passionate about not having their own pain at the loss of loved ones in Israel due to the Hamas attack. Adamant about not having allowing their pain to be weaponized as a justification for the murder of Palestinians. So it's really heroic leadership from our young Jewish friends. And I'd say, you know, hook up with those folks. They're doing amazing, savvy organizing work to help bring about a ceasefire. That's one thing. The other thing is just, you know, keep talking about this issue and educating ourselves about it. There's amazing webinars happening from, you know, groups like the Churches for Middle East Peace, Friends of Sabeel North America, Jewish Voice for Peace, the Arab Center in Washington, D.C. has a number of great webinars fairly regularly, Foundation for Middle East Peace. All of these groups do really good work, and there are many others that open our eyes to what's really going on. I think that's another piece, is even in addition to all these calls we need to be making, I think we have this responsibility to pierce the propaganda. You know, we say if we want peace, work for justice. And if we want justice, we have to be attentive to the truth. Otherwise, we just get lost in the fog of war, and we fall victim to these half-truths and propaganda, and we're paralyzed. We're not motivated. We're not energized for the work of justice, which will eventually lead, we believe, to peace. So, you know, I'd say educate yourself, work at piercing the propaganda and being able to see the truth clearly, and find other groups to do the justice work and the peace building and peacemaking work. I mean, it's the perennial struggle on any issues, racism, sexism, any of these paradigms of oppression. We're really seeing it in heartbreaking ways in front of us now. So we keep doing that work. I would also just say, in churches, I know you'll have a lot of people part of your podcast that are part of churches. You know, if you don't already have a peace and social concerns or peace and justice committee in your church, see if you can get one to start, and pick an issue that you think there's shared passion around, and then be open to all the ways that that issue has resonance with other issues. In my experience, you can't start down this work of peacemaking, this road of peacemaking, without seeing all these connections to any number of other issues that are all around us. And in some ways, it really does come back to that whole thing about God's preferential option for the poor and the oppressed, and goes back to that visit to the hobo camp and seeing the Palestinian refugee camp and all the other things I've been doing in my life, and all of us have been doing in our own ways, to see the world through the eyes of the poor and the oppressed, and to stand with them. And I'll just finish that train of thought by saying that I happened to be in the audience in Seguin, Texas, where Texas Lutheran College was, and the guest speaker was the liberation theologian James Cone. And Cone was there, and he was talking about the God of the oppressed, and a very well-meaning elderly Lutheran laywoman said, Dr. Cone, I just have having a hard time wrapping my head around all this idea of God taking sides. Doesn't God love all of us? And what is this business about God taking side with, you know, the poor and the oppressed? And I mean, it's good that he does, but, you know, how do you square that? How do you reconcile that with God being loving all of us, and all of us are God's loved children? I'll never forget his answer. It was so great. He said, I'm a father. I have two children. I have a 16-year-old boy who's strong and athletic. And I have an 11-year-old daughter who's quite slight of stature. And they occasionally do, as children do, siblings do. They get into a little mix about something. And occasionally it gets a little rough. Here's the thing. I love both of my kids. I love them unconditionally. But when Jamie, my son, goes after my daughter and he uses his physical superior strength against her, and it's you know, hitting her in the arm or something, it's not going to draw blood, but it's still using superior force. Guess where I intervene? I intervene against his use of violence or force against my daughter, because she is unable to defend herself as the one who is weaker. That's how it works. God is going to side with the weaker party, is going to side with the poor, with the oppressed, and going to restrain the oppressor from causing further suffering and harm. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's, you know, it's a little simplistic, I suppose, but I think it's pretty close to where we are now when we look at the situation in Gaza. To stand with the poor and the oppressed is to, at a minimum, at a moral minimum, press for ceasefire.
Yeah. Well, I think that is a perfect place to conclude. I want to thank you so much, Reverend Mark Davidson, for being with us today. And thank you for your expertise, your experience in sharing it with us. Thank you for your heart for justice and for peace, for for Palestinians and for all the world. May it be so in this time of Advent. Blessings to you, my friend. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Great to be with you and with your viewers. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Benders of the Ark podcast, where we explore the stories of those who dare to do the hard work of social change and bending the arc of the Moore universe toward justice. Be sure to subscribe and check out more stories and interviews at bendersoftheark.com. Our music is a splendid creation of Joshua Campbell titled Sing Out, March On. So until next time, keep bending the arc of the Moore universe toward justice for creation and all of God's people.